Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
You know, they say that armies always begin by fighting the previous war all over again, and only later adjust tactics to the actual situation in which they find themselves, their current opponent. And I think we're at one of those moments where we realize that our opponent has changed. And I'm talking about not just COVID, but I'm largely talking, at least initially, about the COVID response. I also think that there are other lessons to be taken from the idea that we're being too rigid in how we think about a lot of things right now. Now, I believe that if we step back and think about the last 2 years, you might be able to come to the conclusion that, at least speaking from someone in the trenches, there's been too much over-reliance on mathematical modeling, on numbers and numbers, and very little emphasis on the experiences of health workers on the front lines of care. And this is becoming, I think, especially important now as we are in the middle of a flare-up that is not flaring up our hospitalizations. We're in the middle of a lot of concern about whether we send children to school, despite the fact that we know that the vast majority of school-age children, even if they are unvaccinated, actually do fairly well with COVID. The pediatric hospitalizations that you hear about going up as a percentage is because the geriatric hospitalizations have gone down because those are the vaccinated and boosted population. And a lot of my patients who are vaccinated and boosted are getting this, and they're not getting very sick. It's the people with lots of comorbidity. We need to worry about them. But do we really need to worry about school-age children? I'm not drawing a conclusion, but I'm asking the question because I think we're not, the advisors and the people in charge are, they're playing by the old playbook still. And I think maybe it's time to switch the playbook. Now, scientific advisors are, people are really afraid of blame. And there's a whole lot of blame to go around, but there's a whole lot of blame throwing. We're a very blamey culture at the moment, and I think that accounts for some of this. Scientific advisors are, you know, very much saying caution. We don't know what's going on. We're uncertain. And they want to make sure that the hospitals don't get overloaded. And they argue that it's too early to conclude that the worst of Omicron is over. They also say there'll probably be another surge in the summer. These are all reasonable points. But the pandemic is now in transition, and we need to acknowledge that. What do we need? We need rigorous surveillance for newer and lethal variants. We need basically to do a genetic test on anyone who gets hospitalized and see what they've got, because sooner or later, that severe case of COVID may be a new variant. And we have tactics now. We've got the PPE on hand. We don't like the things we have to do, but we know how to do them. And I think now it's time to move to a dancing paradigm where when it pushes, we step back. And when it recedes, we step forward. Vulnerable groups will always need to be protected. But we really should be thinking not about a fourth dose of COVID, which I'm starting to hear people talk about, for the vaccinated. We really should be thinking about global vaccination because it's the variants that are going to get us. Personally, the current version of Omicron could just circulate forever, and I could live with that, and so could most of the people who get it. But a new variant, that's a black swan. That's another black swan event. And you know, I personally want to hear an actual debate, not a bunch of people stating their opinions. I want to hear from the clinicians. I want to hear from the scientists, and I want less from the government and less from the public health people, because we're moving out of their paradigm into a different kind of battle, and we need commanders and generals in this battle who have a different perspective. And just to give you a different perspective on healthcare, somewhere in the last, 2014. So in the last 7 years, something really remarkable has happened, but we haven't, it's kind of passed unnoticed. And we are an outlier in this United States. We're embarrassing. All other developed countries guarantee universal health care coverage. And we've tried several times, but again, we've had a war. And the Affordable Care Act is deeply flawed. It massively expanded access to health care. That's wonderful. The number of non-elderly people without insurance went from 48 million to 30 million. Now, I want you to remember that those people with health insurance and health coverage were covered during a 100-year flood of disease. But we didn't get universal coverage. And part of that was deliberate sabotage by politicians. Part of it was some design flaws. And let's talk about the design flaws. The bill's authors, basically, it never occurred to them that states might not choose to expand Medicaid. Here's all this federal money for you to expand Medicaid. But for reasons that have way more to do with political strategy than they have to do with compassion or even appropriate representation of their constituents in those states. But states chose, I think, 12 states chose not to expand Medicaid. And the Supreme Court said they could. They could opt out. So that leaves us with about 2 million poor Americans, most of them in the Southwest and the vast majority of them brown people. Some color besides white, without access to subsidized coverage. Now that stinks. And we just didn't pass a bill that would have repaired that because, again, political calculus, not responsible governance towards your constituency. There's a lot you could say about this outside of healthcare. Climate, clean energy policy. There's important changes that would make a difference in that bill that didn't pass, the Build Back Better. And one of them was it would have put Medicaid in those 12 non-expansion states. It would have made that happen for the poor people. And it would have expanded marketplace subsidies and it would have really been an affordable health plan, setting a lower limit on how much people are expected to pay for coverage. That would be very helpful for the small business people like myself. Well, we don't get reduced prescription drug policy prices. We don't get a lot of things that we could have had. And I really want to say one other thing, particularly in an epidemic, pandemic. You've got to have health care for your undocumented people. They've got to have health care, because when something like this happens, if they can't get health care, then the disease keeps circulating. And we've done great in Santa Cruz County. We have done such masterful outreach that the vaccination rates are marginally higher in the more underserved communities than in certain pockets of the rest of the county. But what we've got now is a patchwork with a lot of holes in it, and we need to do better. And if COVID and what the last 2 years have brought us can't show us that we need to demand actual attention to the health needs of the people rather than the power needs of the party. Well, to quote one of my favorite lines in one of my favorite movies, then we're stupid and we'll die. So let's start with some of our emails. And I'm going to start with one coming from Anna in New Jersey. And Anna writes, "Hi, Dr. Dawn. I'm hoping that you might have some insight into a pesky problem. My daughter, age 32, has repeated tonsil stones. They are white, sticky things stuck in her throat, like little stones. They started, maybe coincidentally, right after an unrelated surgery to another part of the body and have persisted for a couple of years with a break during the time she was pregnant." Ah, important hint there. "And a little while after giving birth." "They are back now and seem to be even worse. She couldn't find any home remedies that work, including gargling, removal with an implement. Do you have any suggestions for eliminating them and any insight into what started them? Thanks for your help." Second email, "Hi. Further addendum, this time they started bleeding after they were poked. Just wanted to add that. Thank you for your help." Well, Anne, I think there's some clues there in the story. Let's start with that unrelated surgery to another part of the body. I always look for surgeries because frequently, and particularly with abdominal surgery or orthopedic surgery, it's routine to give a blast of antibiotics during the surgery. And the idea there is that you get a blood level of antibiotics. It circulates any bacteria that made it into the thing, the orthopedic implant, or made it into the abdomen while you had it open, things like that. You can kill any bacteria that might have somehow snuck in by having high blood levels. And of course, it gets into the capillaries and it gets into the peripheral body fluids, interstitial fluids, so-called extracellular fluid. And once that has a high concentration, you clean just about everything out. Well, including your microbiome. And then the break when she was pregnant, that's also suggestive, that because one of the things that happens during a pregnancy is that there are substantial shifts in what women eat and how much they eat, and also in their hormonal milieu. And all of these things have an effect on the microbiome, sleep-wake cycle. And it's not just the gut microbiome. That's the thing to understand, particularly when it comes to how you eat. And that's going to affect your oral microbiome fairly profoundly. You're also going to have a lot of heartburn and reflux. And some of that's going to get up into your mouth. Every time you taste that vomity taste, that stuff from your stomach made it all the way up on riding on a gas bubble on it. And you belched it up, right? So this is a real thing. So I think that her oral microbiome got shifted. And the oral microbiome loves to inhabit the areas around the teeth, but also those tonsil crypts. And one of the things that the oral microbiome loves to do is it loves to make biofilms. And what is a biofilm? Well, scientific explanation. Biofilms are systematized communities of microorganisms embedded in a hydrated matrix of extracellular polymeric substances let me put it this way. Dental plaque, that's a biofilm. A urinary tract infection, that's a temporary biofilm hopefully on the inside of your bladder, and the bladder bacteria are clinging to the inside, and then they lay down a protective layer. So that's why some bladder infections can be hard to beat or they recur. Many ear infections also form biofilms, which can make them recurrent and difficult to deal with. Sinuses, for sure. So biofilm goes all the way back to stromatolites, which are this early prokaryotic, that is to say, microorganisms that have no nucleus, bacteria being a modern example. These prokaryotic organisms were floating around in the ocean for a while, and then they figured out they could clump together and that they could make things that were gooey and that hardened up and hide under the hardened goo. And there are still these rock-like fossils that you can find in certain places in the world where there used to be an ocean land interface, because this was new territory. And they built like an anthill, effectively, they built their own house. And biofilms occur in lots of places, prostate, gut, you know, basically anywhere there's a surface that a bacteria can grow on, it's going to try to make a biofilm. In fact, the father of microbiology, Van Leeuwenhoek, was able to see these back in 1674 when he scraped plaque off of human teeth. And this is a real survival of the fittest thing. It helps protect the bacteria from the immune system. It helps keep the bacteria in a nutrient-rich area, keeps them from washed away. Nothing like the tooth. Like, you know, think about it. You eat. That's food. Little bits of the food get caught between your teeth. That's a wonderful environment. That's like a banquet. So biofilms are everywhere. And we don't really have great ways of getting rid of biofilms, but we do have some. And I'm going to talk to you about some strategies, because I was able to find some natural substances that are non-toxic that you should be able to use to shift the biofilm and hopefully reduce the frequency. And what's going on with the stones is that the biofilm is allowing for seed crystals to form. These stones are primarily a mixture of mineral and goo. And hey, you're looking at rolled up balls of biofilm that have sequestered mineral in them that has basically precipitated out, a bit like the mineral that you get when you have hard water on the edges of your faucets. Well, let's get her microbiome shifted back. And she can do this, we hope, without having to get pregnant. So looking at biofilms in general, studies have shown that therapeutic doses of N-acetylcysteine and salicylate will actually make a difference in, you can get oral doses and break up biofilms using using these simple technologies. And these are fairly non-toxic substances. So what we're looking at for your daughter in her situation is N-acetylcysteine and aspirin. And another study, which the health food people are going to love this one, apple cider vinegar turns out to be an extremely good way to break up biofilm. You know, you can use it to dissolve the hard water. It breaks up biofilm. So I'm wondering if you could run it through a water pick and just, you know, put the water pick on real low and just aim it back at the tonsils. But that might be too uncomfortable, and we don't want her aspirating. But how about gargling? So you may need to dilute, probably will need to dilute the apple cider vinegar somewhat. If she's not a gagger, you might be able to get it back there with a brush. But I think I'd just try gargling with it a couple times a day. And then, you can wait, you can, whatever concentration you can stand is what you gargle with. The water pick might work as a mechanical thing, but I think try those things. Try shifting the biofilm and see if it makes a difference for her, at least slows them down or possibly even eradicates them altogether. N-acetylcysteine, you can take orally. A helpful dose there might be 1,000 milligrams twice a day. That's a very benign agent. And in fact, we use it in cystic fibrosis. People inhale it. It's called Mucomist, because in cystic fibrosis, guess what you get in the bronchial tree? You get a big, thick, yucky biofilm in the mucus, because the mucus there is so thick that the bacteria immediately move in and make it into a biofilm. So let's fix that and see where we get. Our next email comes from an anonymous, and this is no location, so wants to be very anonymous. And I can understand this, because this person's 25 years old, and I'm sure if anyone identified them, they'd get massive blowback for saying this. Let's read it. I have severe and permanent joint pain from getting the Pfizer vaccine. A few weeks after my second shot, one morning I woke up and all my joints were frozen and aching. I couldn't move and I've been experiencing the same pain around the clock ever since that day. My body now feels 90 years old, not 25. The last 8 months have been filled with extreme pain, sadness, frustration, inability to walk, run, get dressed, exercise, or live the way I used to. I've been tested, and all the inflammatory markers came back normal. It's been confirmed by 3 physicians now, and we're in the process of submitting it to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. I am not capitalized anti-vax. Just 8 months ago, I thought of anti-vaxxers as idiotic subhumans who didn't trust the science. Now, when I hear someone doesn't want to get vaccinated, I have more compassion and understanding towards them. If you have a treatment to recommend, please put it in your podcast so others can benefit as well. Hoping, praying, and wishing this isn't a life sentence. Okay, Anonymous. Well, first of all, I too have seen this a few times post-vaccination, and it's usually brief, but I did have one patient who had it for several months, not, thank goodness, as bad as you have it, but I really think that over time, eventually, when we get out of this mess, we'll probably realize that the dose that we gave was a bigger dose than we needed to give. Now, I'm not saying they weren't right for what they chose based on the information they had. I just think probably it was too large a dose. I can understand wanting to get a high immune reaction, but maybe in some people that's going to cause an overshoot and get something rolling that's going to keep rolling. Now, I think there's something else in your body keeping this going. So my first bit of advice to you is you're going to have to find yourself a functional medicine or a doctor or a naturopath to work with you. And the first place I would go was your microbiome. I think you need to be on an extremely healthy, high vegetable diet. I think you need to feed your gut all the good things and none of the junky stuff. I think you need to stay away from antibiotics. You may need to, and probably eating a bunch of fermented foods would be a good place to start, because I don't care where you are on the planet, you can always make sauerkraut. But I want to talk to you about naltrexone. Naltrexone is a drug that's FDA approved at 50 milligrams a day for alcoholism. It's supposed to block the reward pathway up there in the dopamine land so that you can take one drink and you don't get the one drink calls to the next. So it's approved for maintenance of sobriety after 6 months of being completely alcohol free. You're supposed to be able to take this stuff just before you have a drink is the best way to take it. Maybe an hour or two. The package insert says in the morning, but research out of England says take it a couple of hours before you plan to drink, and it'll help you from getting looped, literally, into drinking too much and getting looped. It's hitting opiate receptors on nerves at that point and affecting dopamine release. But that dose doesn't work for inflammation. There are also opiate receptors on the immune cells, but they can't hear 50 milligrams of concentration. That's too loud and it shuts down their receptors. What their receptors can hear is maybe 3 milligrams, maybe 3.5, maybe 4 milligrams. And natural medicine has been using LDN to mitigate autoimmune diseases like multiple sclerosis in particular for a long time. So I thought to myself, I've used it for rheumatoid arthritis, I've used it for lupus, I've used it for other autoimmune diseases, and effectively you're looking at a sort of long COVID-like syndrome here. So I would absolutely use this to treat long COVID. And I think that I want that information out there. I hope that it goes viral, pardon the pun. But I believe that low-dose naltrexone could be a real game changer for you. And it is benign, okay? 50 milligrams of the stuff isn't toxic and approved. So less than 5 milligrams isn't going to be toxic. That's just not how drug toxicity works. You'll be fine taking this. But it could make a big difference. So I see no reason, since you've had the medical workup and your doctors are like, I don't know. I do want you to make sure you got the autoimmune panel, but assuming that you got the autoimmune panel and it was negative and this didn't kick you off into something, because I have a patient with celiac disease who got much worse after a bout of dengue, right? Inflammation can trigger autoimmune disease and the immune system gets triggered and it just never shuts up after that. So give it a try. It definitely falls into the won't hurt, might help category. Let's go to one more email and then we'll do some science stories. Marianne in Johnston, PA, writes, I'm an RN with a hospice company. My boyfriend Sam has been having issues that appeared like early onset dementia. He's 56 years old. We finally got him to a neurologist who ruled out dementia, but found he had elevated MMA. For my audience, that's methylmalonic acid. His level is 1,110. We were told for his PCP to start B12 shots. His first shot was this past weekend. The neurologist put this in the PCP's hands, and the PCP says to see the neurologist. Yeah. And both of them are just hoping the other one will hold on to the hot potato, by the way, Marianne. He also has Crohn's disease, which makes this more difficult to navigate. Where do we turn for more information on diet, etc.? Please help. Well, Crohn's disease can damage the small intestine, and so I'm a little concerned that possibly he has damage to the part of the small intestine, which is the distal small intestine, if I remember my gut physiology correctly, where B12 is absorbed. So going around the digestive tract is not a bad idea, although you might be able to get away with just oral B12 after a while. But the methylmalonic acid being this high is very, very unusual. So I think you for sure want to see that his B12 level is also quite low and see how low it is, because there are other reasons he could have this. And one of them is that he might have a problem with one of the enzymes that cycles B12. So let's just talk a little bit about what's going on here. B12 is an important factor in something called the methylation cycle, and it enters this cycle after folic acid has entered it, and you've converted your folic acid into methyl tetrahydrofolate, and then the B12 enters into the cycle and is a cofactor for the conversion into methionine, and then methionine gets turned into S-adenosylmethionine, that's SAMe, and then that gets turned into homocysteine, and then that gets turned back into methionine. And if that cycle doesn't loop, what you end up with is methylmalonic acid overload. And it's benign, but it's a marker for a breakdown in an extremely important process. And sometimes people have, that's a very, very high MMA level. And I've seen a lot of people with mutations in their in B12, and I've seen a lot of malabsorption, and I think we have to figure out which one we're looking at. So my advice is going to be very straightforward. You go ahead on the shots, but make sure that he's taking a B complex with methylated folate and other B vitamins, because you don't want to imbalance the B vitamins, and injections will do that if you're not careful. Secondly, try to get adenyl or methylated B12 in the shots rather than the cyanocobalamin. That's not that big a problem. But third, he needs to get a 23andMe. And then once you've done that, you want to work with me or with another functional medicine doctor to get that analyzed and see that we are not overloading his system. Takes about a month to get a 23andMe, and they changed the laws so we can do this over the phone We can do Zoom. And he's going to need guidance. If there's a functional medicine doctor who's a certified functional medicine practitioner in your area, they'll be able to help you. And that it's always better if you can see people in person. But you need to get help from someone who knows what's going on here. And I know that the neurologist knows what he knows. The family physician knows what he or she knows, or I'm sorry, they know. Let's use the neutral pronoun here. But we in functional medicine know way more about this. And if it's affecting his brain, he's at high risk for painful neuropathy as well. So this needs to be addressed right away, and it needs to be addressed appropriately. So I wanted to be sure we didn't not get that out to you right away, since that was a recent email. Fascinating deep science story for you. They've unraveled the detailed mechanism of how the bacterial endotoxin called lipopolysaccharide, it's kind of a sugar fat molecule that is a recognition signal in the cell wall of bacteria. And this either prevents or promotes the development of asthmas and allergic disease. So remember the idea that children who grew up in barnyards who have a lot of pets have less allergies? Well, it's because their microbiome's different, and therefore the breakdown products of those bacteria, that is to say the cell wall, is different, and so you get a different response. But we've got lots of studies showing that if you have LPS in your system when you're exposed to environmental allergens, it protects against developing asthma and allergies. But we also have other studies that shows that LPS during exposure actually does the opposite. It promotes the development. So how can this be? And a study recently published shows that it depends on the allergen. So in other words, the way that the immune system and LPS interact is going to vary depending on the allergen. It's not when you think logically about it, it's not surprising, but asthma is a very big deal. And what they found was a complex trail of mechanisms for LPS to either promote or prevent allergic disease by either activating or suppressing a line of T cells called T helper 2 immune cells. So it turns out you have to have an enzyme in the allergen itself that is called cysteine protease. And if the allergen like house dust, if the allergens contain that, like house dust mites, papaya enzyme, these lead to the prevention of sensitization in the presence of LPS. But you've got cockroach antigen, which doesn't have cysteine protease activity. So that's going to promote sensitization. The cysteine protease on the allergen somehow activates the immune system to instruct it to downregulate and suppress the response of the T cells. The fact that this is contingent on the allergen itself is rather surprising. It turns out that when you've got the LPS and the cysteine protease, you actually change the differentiation of cells all over the body, but especially in the lungs, to produce suppression. So we're producing kind of interleukins, chemical signals that suppress the immune system in the presence of LPS when this enzyme is around to co-activate it. So interesting and so complicated. And where does it take us from here? Well, it takes us a step forward in eliminating allergies entirely, and that's a good direction to be taking. Another deep science story today. I started off talking about a battle and about battle strategy, and we've just talked about a kind of battle, the immune system attacking an antigen. And we're going to talk about another battle. That's the sort of theme of our program this week. And that's the battle over nutrition between the mother and the father's genes in the womb. So there's a tug of war between the genes inherited from the father and the genes inherited in the mother. Now, obviously, as a fetus grows, it needs to communicate its increasing needs for food to the mother, and it receives its nourishment via blood vessels and the placenta, which we all know that. But about 10% of babies grow poorly in the womb, and they show reduced growth of blood vessels in the placenta. When you get to around the fourth month of pregnancy, these blood vessels begin to expand dramatically, reaching a total length. If you were to lay them all out, you know, end to end, we got 188 miles of blood vessels. So, in a recent study, the scientists were looking at trying to understand how a fetus produces a signal to encourage the growth of blood vessels, and this is a signal that basically causes the placenta to shunt more nutrients from the mother into the fetus. And one of these signals is called IGF-2, insulin-like growth factor 2. It comes into the placenta through the umbilical cord, and if you get too much of IGF-2, you get too much growth, and you get a large for gestational age baby. And if you don't get enough, you have a small for gestational age baby or even a death at birth. But that's IGF-2. What we now see is that there are two genes that produce both IGF-2 and the IGF-2 receptor. And we can tell by looking at the gene that these come from the father. These always come from the father. Now, of course, the mother has a copy of the receptor and the IGF molecule itself, but hers, but the IGF-2 gene in the father is active, and in the fetus, the IGF-2 receptor from the mother is active. So, if you make a lot of the father's gene, you're going to get a signal to grow. The mother's gene basically downregulates when there's too much demand for resources. The maternally expressed genes will actually drop the number of receptors so that there's less action, because otherwise you deplete the mother's body too badly. So essentially you get receptor downregulation from the mother if the father's gene tries to make too much signal. And this is a dynamic balance. When it goes right, you get a healthy baby with a normal birth weight. But it's also, if you stop and think about it, the father's evolutionary advantage is to ensure the survival of that child by making it as big and strong as possible. And the mother is kind of, well, too bad, so sad if we hurt her. The mother's body, on the other hand, has an interest in staying alive and not getting too depleted and not having a baby that's so big that it's going to kill her trying to be delivered. So we have this amazing sort of, I want more. No, you can't have it. I want more. No, you can't have it. Taking place in, and the battleground here is the placenta itself. I think we've got just enough time, so I'm going to dive into this one. Another battle, if you will, is autoimmune disease. And I had alluded to this a little bit on last week's or the week before last's show. I don't remember which. But I found the article, and I want to go a little bit deeper down into these viruses that stimulate autoimmune disease and what's going on with these. About 8% of the human genome, as I said, is virus that has been there. It's a paleovirus, really. It's been in the human genome for a very, very long time, you know, probably back when we were back to the Lucy era is when some of these got into what eventually became our genome. And these viruses have become incapable of being infectious. So unlike chickenpox, because you can get chickenpox from somebody with shingles, right? If they've got, there's chickenpox virus in that shingles rash. And you can get oral herpes or genital herpes from someone with genital herpes because that rash contains active, competent virus. But while these viruses can cause cancer, they can also, by just damaging DNA, right, if it gets into the wrong place, you, like, for example, cervical cancer caused by the human papillomavirus that happens to get into the wrong place, it likes to put itself basically in a tumor control location that controls growth and differentiation of the cervix or the mucosa. That's another way that viruses can hurt us. But in this case, it's so intriguing that a virus that is millions of years old can be partially competent. It can be capable of arousing itself and waking up. And then under the circumstances of its revival, make partial copies of itself. And these partial copies are things that our immune system can identify and recognize, but they're also a case of mistaken identity. So they activate the immune system, and they very well may act like an antigen and activate the immune system to actually make antibodies against self. So there are probably multiple evolved mechanisms that prevent this from happening, that downregulate and prevent these self-attacks. And in fact, we know that during our development of our immune system in childhood, and this happens, they do this to you in medical school. It's kind of one long 4-year hazing process, honestly. But in medical school or your early training, they'll throw up an X-ray of a baby on the thing, and they'll say, "Well, what's your diagnosis?" And you'll look at it and you think, "Oh my God, this baby has double pneumonia or a tumor or something. There's this big ginormous thing that's covering, you know, a third of the lung, and you know, a third of the chest cavity." And you're like, "Oh, it's terrible." And nope, it's the thymus, which shrivels up into something the size of a grape later on, but is this big organ in your chest when you're young. And what we think the thymus does is literally review all of the antigens that are normally made in the human body and create a suppressor cell to prevent the immune system from being auto-sensitized to it. And so maybe certain tendencies towards autoimmune disease have something to do with this, with the thymus not getting it completely right, the thymus missing some things. Or maybe it's over and done with, and it's supposed to work forever, and these viruses manage to foil it. Multiple sclerosis has long been associated, and it goes all the way back to 1989, that it was discovered the HERV-W, human endogenous retrovirus. And that particular compound is not a functional infectious virus. It's found in active. It's found in 12.5% of the general human population. And obviously 12.5% of the population don't get multiple sclerosis. So it's not just the virus causing it. There are other factors here. But the fact that it's present in everyone that's been studied with multiple sclerosis, and that the amount of it correlates with the severity and progression of the disease, and I might add, for those of you who either have multiple sclerosis or are familiar with it, one of the best ways to treat your multiple sclerosis is to alter your microbiome. And there is a physician named Terry Walls who has written extensively on the subject and has clinics and has made essentially a second career. She used to work as a physician at the VA, but after she got multiple sclerosis, she found a way to cure herself through diet. And it's a strict diet, but it's a very healthy one. And it makes a difference in the progression of the disease. So it's not just the virus. You can use the immune system here to do something. There's another one, HERV W, is also found in schizophrenia. And so now we're looking at fluid in 2005, looking at schizophrenia possibly being related, at least in some level, in some people, to a protein that's made from the DNA that came from a virus. People with ALS, HERV K, same thing, uncontrolled immune attack on the system. And I think it's hugely important that we realize that this requires us to start working on it pronto, because I'm thinking, okay, we have just been playing around with rapid manufacture of antiviral monoclonal antibodies. That technology just got a huge kick in the pants from COVID. And that technology should be able to grab the viral compound, the protein that the virus is making, or the polyamine that's not big enough to be a protein, call it a protein fragment or a polypeptide, this thing that's triggering the immune system in these people, we should be able to clean it by simply hitting it with antibodies and that are tailored to attack it and take it out of circulation so that the immune system doesn't continue the assault. We should be able to deactivate it. There has to be a way to use this new weapon that's been evolved to fight one enemy, to fight a different enemy entirely. We now have the technology to make enormous, enormous strides in understanding all of these diseases that we've not been able to do anything more than patch. The drugs that we use for autoimmune diseases impair the immune system substantially, and that's a problem. I want to see better drugs that don't cause people to be at increased risk for cancer and in drastically increased risk for the next pandemic that comes along. We need to do better, not hobble the immune system, but modulate the immune system with targeted therapies, and our new technology gives us a real chance to do it. We also have some new antiretroviral drugs that have come online, and these need to be tested against different types of autoimmune disease. I think it's fascinating that autoimmune diseases are aggravated by inflammation. Obviously, COVID's a highly inflammatory thing. We had that email earlier from that poor young person. And I think that that person was probably a setup to get some sort of autoimmune reaction, maybe one that he or she isn't showing us exactly the blood levels and the serologies, because we don't have a test for that yet, but it's a thing. It's a thing for them. Antiretroviral should be tried if you can't get anywhere with other things. And the antiretrovirals do seem to be working against these human endogenous viruses. So if we can stop the loop, cut the chain, we may make some amazing, amazing things. There was actually treating type 1 diabetes, which is treated with autoimmune anti-tumor rejection drugs. If you catch it early enough, it works, but you have to keep them on the drug. Maybe antivirals will get rid of the trigger. I think the virus acts as a trigger. So if we can not pull the trigger or unpull the trigger, we can probably make a huge difference in people's lives.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. production and editing by Charles Mansky, music by John Scoville.